From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Everybody says they hate, loathe, and despise negative political ads. The only problem is they work.
They are trying to confuse voters and get them to either vote differently than they otherwise would.
Also this week, since almost forever, the term socialist has been a political insult, but suddenly certain groups are embracing the word.
And we Democratic Socialists are actually proposing a number of things that a lot of people say they like.
We'll also gear up for next week's big back-to-school event with several stories about the preparations parents, school districts, and even a Florida police department are making in anticipation. I'm Tom Flanagan. On air and online, this is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. It's election season again, and mailboxes, inboxes, and social media feeds across Florida are filling with political attack ads. Many voters say they hate them, but experts say campaigns keep using them for one simple reason. They work. Tristan Wood reports.
While many voters say they're annoyed by what sometimes feels like a deluge of negative campaign texts, calls, and emails, experts say those communications play to how human brains work.
We tend to have a bias towards negativity. We just remember it better. It elicits a emotional reaction. And, you know, those emotions stick with us more than, like I said, the facts and figures and policy points that, you know, again, we'd like to believe that campaigns end up being about, decision making is about.
That's Jay Revel, owner of Revel Media and an adjunct instructor in Florida State University's Master's in Applied American Politics and Policy program that focuses on teaching about political campaigns. He says negative political ads prey on humans' preference to avoid bad outcomes.
It's just a lot easier to remember the two or three reasons you don't like a candidate versus the long list of reasons you should like a candidate.
It's the same principle that drives why a lot of media of all stripes focus on negative news. While people don't enjoy hearing it, that type of information is more likely to stick in their memories. Aubrey Jewett is a political science professor at the University of Central Florida.
You know, if you ask people if they like negative ads, almost universally the answer is no. People say they do not like them. But psychology finds that people tend to prioritize negative information over positive news, and that's just sort of a natural thing that people do. So although most of us say we don't like negative ads, and we probably don't, we are impacted by them.
But attack ads are only effective to a certain extent. Jewett says they are unlikely to impact races with wider margins, but are heavily influential in close races, or races with many candidates running in them. In those contests, he says negative ads are commonly used to reduce turnout in groups likely to support a certain candidate.
They are trying to confuse voters and get them to either vote differently than they otherwise would, or they are trying to suppress the vote and get it and make it so that people just don't turn out at all or don't send their ballot in.
And putting out attack ads comes with risks for campaigns. Revel says there can be blowback from attack ads if they are not convincing to voters.
If someone feels like they're you know, being deceived, if they feel like there's hypocrisy in play with some of these negative attacks, that can really have again, that opposite effect of what the, you know, whoever the person doing the communicating is trying to do.
He says that blowback is more likely in local and smaller state legislative races, where elected officials represent a smaller area and are more closely connected to the regions they serve.
A lot of times people know these candidates, right? You know, you either know them personally or you see them at the grocery store or at church or when you're dropping or picking up your kids. And there's some things that just, you know, aren't true. And again, that can resonate in an interesting way. If someone tries to sell a bill of goods on someone that's just not accurate, you can have a real negative blowback to that.
To avoid potential blowback, attack ads often don't come from a candidate's campaign directly. Many come from political committees not explicitly tied to one candidate or another. Jewett says those committees make it challenging to tie a particular attack to one group supporting a specific candidate.
They will collect money, then transfer money to another group, who might transfer money to another group, and then if you're trying to figure out who's actually behind it, it can be very difficult, if not impossible, to follow that trail of money.
During a time when those communications are frequent and their origins are often unclear, Revel recommends that people be skeptical and discerning about the political communication they receive.
If someone sends you a piece of information, you should just always be discerning. You know, do your own homework and, you know, go and see if that claim is accurate. Go and see if that thing that they're saying about that candidate is truthful. And, you know, if it's not, you need to take that into account, too.
I'm Tristan Wood.
The Democratic Socialists of America have taken midterm election season by storm nationally, but it remains to be seen whether their progressive playbook can gain a foothold in the Sunshine State. WUSF's Phoebe Martell dug into the DSA's Florida prospects, which should become clearer when a few key races are decided in this month's primary.
24-year-old union organizer Oliver Larkin is seeking to unseat incumbent Democrat Jared Moskowitz in Broward County, while Angie Nixon's gunning for a nomination over Alex Vindman in the U.S. Senate race. These progressive challengers say they want to tackle the state's affordability crisis and knock their opponents for taking money from the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, also known as AIPAC. Aubrey Jewett is a University of Central Florida political science professor. He says Florida is a tough terrain for Democratic Socialists, but their cause may not be lost, even in such a deep red state. Aubrey, we've seen the DSA pick up some major electoral wins in some parts of the country, most famously New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani, but we've also got some candidates here in Florida that are running as Democratic Socialists. What do you think of their chances?
I would say this, if Angie Nixon wins, I would consider that an upset, and it would really show that the Democratic base is totally frustrated with moderate politics as usual, and they're looking for their own version of Mamdani or, you know, somebody like that.
And what are some Florida-specific limitations to a Democratic Socialist wave?
Florida skews older, and so a lot of seniors are more skeptical of that label. We have a disproportionate number of Hispanics who have come from countries that had autocratic left-wing dictators, and now they're here in the United States. And by God, they didn't come to the United States just to have a repeat of socialism.
Yeah, that definitely seems like a bit of an uphill battle. So how can the Florida DSA appeal to these voters?
Particularly now, a lot of Democratic Socialists are saying, look, affordability is like the number one issue for most voters and most Floridians. And we Democratic Socialists are actually proposing a number of things that a lot of people say they like. Most people say, yeah, they want to see average working people be able to make more and get a bigger share of the pie.
Yeah, I have heard it said, though, that younger and college-educated kids tend to be the most attracted to Democratic Socialism. Can you tell me why that is?
Younger people are not necessarily economically comfortable right now. Middle-class kids, they are really feeling the pinch right now. And I think also younger people traditionally often think more with their heart and their emotion and wonder why the world is the way it is and can't we do something to make it a little more fair?
Democratic Socialists do seem to be having a moment at the national level, at least. Do you think this will last?
I will say, though, Democratic Socialists have been associated with two things that are more controversial, two issues. One was a lot of Democratic Socialists were part of that defund the police movement, and that has not aged well, politically speaking. And then the other one is the issue of Israel and Gaza. Three quarters of people who identify as Jewish tend to support the Democratic Party. I might add also, there are some Jewish voters who believe it's not anti-Jewish to say that the country of Israel sometimes has done some bad thing.
So what lessons can the Florida DSA take from those controversies?
In the rank and file population, I think that's still a bit of a turnoff, the label. Just kind of downplay the label, but increase the focus on issues that people care about.
That was UCF political science professor Aubrey Jewett speaking with WUSF's Phoebe Mortel. Governor Ron DeSantis says a rewrite is already underway as the state will not appeal a Leon County judge's ruling against the title and ballot summary language in a property tax cut referendum legislators put before voters in November. The measure will go on the ballot as Amendment 3. DeSantis also says he and Attorney General James Uthmeyer, who's overseeing the rewrite, didn't agree with Circuit Court Judge David Frank, who ordered the title and ballot summary to be redrafted because the language contained political rhetoric and was misleading. DeSantis says people will know what they're voting on.
It addresses what the judge said, even though we don't necessarily agree with the legal analysis. It's fine. It's going to be a very good summary, very straightforward. People are going to know. You're going to get tax relief.
The lawsuit was brought by three groups opposed to the amendment. Democratic State Representative Rob Long says the plan would hurt local governments.
This is a shell game. The governor is going to blow a hole in your city's budget or your county's budget, then blame the city or county for trying to patch it up. He gets to walk away with the political headline while the local officials, police officers, the firefighters, and the residents are all left dealing with the aftermath.
Amendment 3 calls for the non-school homestead exemption to be increased from $50,000 to $150,000 in 2027 and $250,000 in 2028. Coming up on Capitol Report, for some Florida school districts, the relationship with AI is a complicated thing, a potentially powerful tool that could also cripple the students it's supposed to help.
We're taking away the critical thinking piece, the problem solving, the gathering of research and information.
Police in the capital city have launched an initiative to get officers more autism training.
It really is this complete effort of doing some education with our law enforcement and first responders, but also with our families and individuals.
And while picking up the kids' notebooks and a protractor, make sure they're also scheduled for an eye exam.
We feel that the first eye exam should be done between 6 months and 12 months of age.
For many Florida counties, the first day of school's right around the corner. Along with students, artificial intelligence is heading back to the classroom, too. As Central Florida Public Media's Kayla Kissel reports, districts aren't outright banning AI, but they are thinking about how it can be used in the classroom.
Some districts already have AI tools and guidelines in place. Others are just starting to roll out policies for this school year. For example, Brevard allows AI for research and student feedback, but not to write papers. Seminole has three new district-approved AI tools, and Orange County now allows certain AI for research, but requires teacher permission for graded work. Orange County School Board member Maria Salamanca says writing the policy has felt like, quote, building a plane while flying.
I think that this board, above all else, mostly care truly about like safety and guardrails, right? We don't know yet what this looks like, and I think this is a policy that's going to come back every single year.
But even with those guardrails, Johns Hopkins neuropsychologist Jennifer Katzenstein says putting more AI into classrooms could mean students do less of the thinking themselves.
We're taking away the critical thinking piece, the problem solving, the gathering of research and information by offloading that task to another device software platform.
As school districts work on the implementation of these new guidelines, many say those policies could change. The state is rolling out its own guidance on how AI should be used in schools. Kayla Kissel.
The CDC says one in every 31 children is on the autism spectrum. Tallahassee Police recently launched an autism awareness initiative that includes more training for officers and free decals to alert law enforcement that someone in a vehicle during a traffic stop may have autism. A free resource for these individuals and their families is the FSU Center for Autism and Related Disabilities, known as FSU CARD. The center also trains law enforcement in how to communicate with people on the spectrum. Florida lawmakers established 7 such centers statewide decades ago. Gina Jordan sat down with FSU CARD director Catherine Zenko.
One of the things of autism is they often perceive sensory stimuli differently than we do, either heightened or not as much. Think about a situation, either law enforcement or EMT coming to a scene. What do you see? Lights. What do you hear? Really loud sirens, all of these things. And so if you're already at a state and this is something that comes in, it can be really disturbing.
Yeah.
Right? It's loud. And then people are rushing in, right? Because it's an emergency, right? And they're coming at you fast. Mm-hmm. And that can feel threatening. And if you can't communicate and people just keep asking you the same question, maybe louder because they think you didn't hear it, you just kind of get this sense of overwhelm. So another thing that can be misinterpreted, or if they don't have a way to communicate effectively, especially in a stressful situation, when a law enforcement officer asks you a question or tells you to stop, right? But if you're feeling threatened, you run. Right? Mm-hmm. Because they're in a fight or flight state. And so now it looks like you're resisting arrest, right? And you're running away. And so there are all of these factors that unfortunately contribute to the stories that we end up seeing on the news.
Yeah.
You know, that is also a really neat thing about FSU CARD is because we're also the ones, we're not only interacting with the first responders. I get to interact with the people themselves who are on the spectrum. And so we do, we talk about that. We also try and put together some supports and information that the people on the spectrum, depending on where they are, can understand of what to do in the event that you're approached by a police officer. You know, what not to do. If you communicate using your phone and it's in your back pocket, we need to say, don't reach for that yet. You need to say to the officer or have something in your vehicle or wherever you are to hand them to say, I need to get my phone to communicate. Can I get it? Mm-hmm. Because when I'm thinking of these situations, I do kind of like to do a 360-degree perspective check. Mm-hmm. The law enforcement officer, what do they need to know? But what do I need to talk to my individuals on the spectrum about too? What they may think is harmless because I need to grab my thing to communicate might look like you're reaching for something that's unsafe.
Yeah.
And so it really is this complete effort of doing some education with our law enforcement and first responders, but also with our families and individuals.
Yeah. This is a sidebar question,
sure.
But this is also in the news. We know that children with autism who wander off can be drawn to bodies of water. It could be the neighbor's pool. It could be the lake at the end of the street. And we know that that has led to deaths. What do we know about this pattern and why that happens?
Well, it's a great question in the fact that it is in the news and it is a huge issue. It's very sad. But the number one cause of death in children on the spectrum is drowning. Oftentimes, they like the sensory aspect of the water. Couple that with they may not have that sense of danger awareness. Right? And so if they are singularly drawn, like that's one of the things that is a characteristic of autism is this kind of singular or hyper-focus on something that they're very interested in, that's the driving force is, oh, I hear a stream, I need to go check it out because I really love water. And they are just like their focuses get to the water and may not know to look up and look around. And I can't just cross the street to get to the water because there might be cars coming. Mm. Or the current might be too strong and it's really cool to look at, but they don't necessarily understand that, you know, if I can't swim really well, or even if you can, if you get into a body of water that has a lot of current.
Yeah.
The good news about this is it's getting a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting a lot of attention also in our legislature, which is fantastic. There is funding now for swim lessons. There are pool alarms. The pool alarms are one thing to alert if somebody unexpectedly gets into the water. But I really like the two-prong approach of we don't just need the alarms, we need the swimming lessons. Another thing that started July 1 is a new spectrum alert. It's much like an Amber alert. This is the same concept with the new spectrum alert that when a child or an adult goes missing, it can activate the same type of response because of what we know, that time is of the essence. Water is usually a huge factor in where we want to make sure that we're looking. And also this lack of danger
awareness. You also may have somebody on the spectrum who really loves trains, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so now you're going to go to the, you know, the, so these are the things we need to know. So when they call in the alert, they're going to ask these questions. Do they like water? Are there any bodies of water close to you? What else are they really drawn to so they know where to go?
Yeah.
So I think Florida has really put quite a commitment to our citizens here with autism, and we're really proud to be a part of the solutions.
That was FSU CARD Director Catherine Zenko speaking with Gina Jordan. State university officials want Congress to pass an antitrust exemption for the NCAA to establish a salary cap, along with transfer and eligibility regulations on student athletic programs. The recommendation was one of 19 proposals the State University System's Task Force on Intercollegiate Athletics discussed during a meeting this week. Ultimately, the panel backed 7 ideas to adapt to the evolving world of college athletics. Without federal action, the panel would recommend the Florida legislature join multi-state agreements on issues ranging from student pay and eligibility to caps on student athlete agent compensation. Ken Jones is the chairman of the task force.
The legal and the regulatory framework governing college athletics remains very unsettled. While there are significant natural interests in establishing greater consistency, the details of the framework are still being debated, and the ultimate outcome remains very uncertain.
Measures that found support include the need to expand state law that protects universities regarding student-athlete name, image, and likeness deals, and providing student-athletes with financial literacy training and advisors. The panel also voiced support for regulations on agents, from registration and fees to a cap on compensation. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, as parents race about shopping for back-to-school items, doctors remind parents to make sure their child has an eye exam. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford talks with Dr. Terry Geist, president of the American Optometric Association, about why eye exams are especially important for young students.
Dr. Geist, kids normally get their vision screenings at school or at their annual well visit at their doctor's office. So why is it important for kids to actually have a back-to-school in-person eye exam with an eye doctor?
School screenings vary widely as far as what they check, but most of the time they just check faraway vision. And we know, especially now, that kids are on digital devices a lot. And so that up-close vision issue is something that we need to check a little bit more thoroughly. Being able to see clearly is one thing, but being able to sustain that accommodation and focusing is really, really important. And making sure they have binocular vision, making sure that the eyes team together and are comfortable doing that for a sustained period of time. The other thing is making sure that they have great internal eye health, making sure that the eyes work together as a team and all of the things that go along with that. We want to set them up for success, and a comprehensive eye exam will do that. A lot more goes into it than just checking faraway vision. That's why we feel that a comprehensive in-person eye exam is important for kids before they enter school.
How young should a child get an eye exam like this?
Through our evidence-based research that we've done at the American Optometric Association, we feel that the first eye exam should be done between 6 months and 12 months of age, and then once through preschool, and then once before kindergarten, and then every year after that while they're in school. Early detection of any of those issues I just mentioned are important for kids' overall well-being.
And then how does undiagnosed vision problems, how do they show up in students' behavior at school and at home?
You know, it's one of those things that if you've got a child sitting in the classroom and they may have kids around them that are doing well, and if they're trying to complete a project or task or homework and it's blurry or they can't sustain focusing, they may get frustrated. And that frustration may form into behavioral issues, headaches, that kind of thing. And if that happens, their self-esteem may go down. They may act out. And so if that happens, you know, that may be a quarter or a semester. It may turn into the whole year, which may lead into the next year and the next year. And so if that happens, it's really sad. And you know, if it's an eye issue that could have been taken care of through a comprehensive exam, that's something that would have set that child up for success. And so that's why we always hope that we can make sure that that child is ready to learn. And because if you can't see, you can't learn. And so we want to make sure that we help with that. And again, help with the overall health of the children's vision.
And children might not even understand that they have poor vision or that their vision's getting worse. They just become accustomed to it day by day.
Exactly. And kids don't know what they don't know. And they think, you know, because it's their own vision, they don't know it's abnormal. And so they may not complain to mom and dad that, hey, I can't see. So I think parents wait a lot of times to say, gosh, my child isn't complaining. They're not saying I can't see and are having problems. So parents shouldn't wait because, again, children don't know what they don't know with their vision. And so, again, behavior, those kinds of things might be an indicator, but the academic performance sometimes is and sometimes isn't an indicator, especially in those early years. What sometimes happens is it catches up with them in high school when academics gets a little bit more challenging. And so if we catch things again early detection is so key in this whole situation. So parents should just make that, again, part of their back to school. When you buy the backpacks and the crayons and things, make sure that the back to school eye exam is part of that success.
Now, is there help if someone does not have money to pay for an annual exam? They don't have vision insurance. Is there help?
It's rare that kids don't have coverage through their regular medical plans. So it is rare. And there are programs out there that can help also through their local communities.
Can you walk us through what credentials should a parent look for when they're trying to find an eye doctor for their child? Is it okay to go to get an exam at an optical center that we see in a big supermarket or warehouse shopping store? Or does it have to be, you know, at a hospital setting?
Yeah, you know, the best, we've got a doctor locator. If you go to aoa.org/I deserve more, and it's EYE, deserve more, so don't think I. And so it's aoa.org/I deserve more, EYE, deserve more. And we have a doctor locator there, and that is got, has the doctor locator, and it will help you find a doctor of optometry that is very helpful in your area.
That was Dr. Terry Geist, president of the American Optometric Association, speaking with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Randy Buxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Phoebe Martell, Kayla Kissel, and Jennifer Crawford. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.